Thank you all very much for attending this Lands of the Round Table's 2010 annual meeting here at Amelia Island. And thank you for attending Restoring Habitat to the Gulf. The wetlands along the Gulf of Mexico are one of the United States' greatest natural resources, home to thousands of unique and diverse species, as well as a multi-billion-dollar fishing and shipping industry. The wetlands also offer unique protection to low-lying coastal cities such as New Orleans. The recent BP oil spill poses a significant threat to these wetland wildlife, as well as a threat that philanthropy is in a unique position to combat. Our speaker today, Mr. Dale Hall, CEO of Ducks Unlimited, a Memphis-based nonprofit organization dedicated to preserving waterfowl and wetland habitats in North America. Mr. Hall was a director of National U.S. Fish and Wildlife for 31 years, and from 2005 to 2009, he was the director there. He had 7,500 employees he was responsible for, and before joining the U.S. Fish and National Wildlife Service in 1978, Mr. Hall served for 4 years in the U.S. Air Force, as well as a year in Mississippi on an aquaculture operation. Mr. Hall is also an avid hunter, a patient fisher, and an avid captive patient fishing. And that's really the basis of being a conservationist, an understanding and appreciation of the beautiful places in America and in nature, as well as an understanding of the inherent value in preserving and protecting those. So without further ado, I give you Mr. Dale Hall, CEO of Ducks Unlimited.
Thank you and good morning.
Good morning.
I will stand here just so that I can make sure I'm following it okay. That's better. First of all, I really do appreciate the opportunity to come speak with you this morning. Conservation is something that is certainly part of my value system, and we work very hard to make it part of the American value system. Over the years, conservation has been really important to all of us, and I'll go through some of those reasons as we move forward here. I'll spend only 3 or 4 slides telling you about Ducks Unlimited, because I really want to talk to you about the oil spill and what's been going on and our view of what's been happening and may happen in the future. So let me just start off by saying that Ducks Unlimited, our mission statement is to we conserve, restore, and manage wetlands and associated habitats for North America's waterfowl. And obviously all wetlands benefit all life, and so it's really important. Many people think that Ducks Unlimited is a hunting organization. We're very proud of our hunting tradition. We're very proud that hunters are the ones that stepped up in 1937 to help create Ducks Unlimited. But nowhere in our mission or our vision statement is hunting there. We believe that the resource is the most important aspect, and how we use it is an individual choice. We certainly do, as Mike said, I love to go hunting. The patient part of fishing, I'm not sure, but I'll work on that. Ducks Unlimited began in 1937 and was established in the midst of the Dust Bowl. I think it's important to think about what was going on then. At the turn of the century, commercial hunting had just been outlawed. Commercial hunting was doing more devastation to wildlife in this country than anything that we had ever seen and maybe have seen since. And it was the sport hunter, the sportsman that stood up and really rang the alarm, worked with Teddy Roosevelt and others to do away with commercial hunting. And I would just point out something a lot of people really don't think about, but in the history since we eliminated commercial hunting, there has been no sport-managed species ever go extinct. And I think that's really important because the hunters have tended to really put their money where their mouth is and pay for conservation, live by rules, and make sure that things are done properly when they go out to harvest the resource. We have more than 1 million supporters in North America, about 750,000 adult members, 100,000 youth, and 60,000 volunteers. Our staff is only 450 people. But we have 60,000 people across this country that give their time to go out and do the work at Ducks Unlimited as a sideline for what they normally do for a living. We do work in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, and we have an annual operating budget of around $340 million. And what we're really proud of is our efficiency. We're ranked number 103 out of 1.4 million U.S. 501c3 nonprofit organizations on gross income and amount and the amount that actually reaches the ground. Why do we do what we do? Wetlands and grasslands are among North America's most productive habitats. And I am a wetlands biologist by training, and I can tell you that I became a believer in studying the sheer science of wetlands and all the benefits that they provide. More than 900 wildlife species, but I can say that I don't know of a single wildlife species that doesn't use a project of restoring wetlands that we put on the ground if it's in the range of that species, because all species need water. And water is the key to life, and I believe that water is the issue of the 21st century. And so we see ourselves as much as a water organization as we do a waterfowl and wildlife organization, because without the habitat, we cannot restore the wildlife. Wetlands have all kinds of benefits, from purifying and removing pollutants, recharging, or as serving as discharge areas for groundwater. They help reduce soil erosion and provide recreation opportunities for millions, whether you go to hunt, to fish, or to take pictures, or simply to observe, or to go, as I like to say, to my cathedral, where I can communicate with my maker. And that is the place that I do it mostly. When the sun is coming up in the morning, the mist is rising up over the water, I realize what a gift I've been given to live and to share the treasures that we've been given. This is just a map to show you how we work in all 50 states, all over the nation, all over the continent, rather. But the yellow dots are projects that we have put on the ground. They do, though, have focus areas, and you can see that we have four flyways, or highways, if you will, that birds migrate from the northern part where they nest down to the southern part where they winter, and they fly back and forth each year. Migratory waterfowl go the Atlantic Flyway, the Mississippi Flyway, the Central Flyway, and the Pacific Flyway. So that's the way the birds are managed each year, especially hunted waterfowl like ducks and geese. We do surveys in the North American plateaus up here, the northern part of the United States, and in Canada. And they are called traditional survey areas because they've been flown the same routes since the early 1950s for consistency of data. And they tell the director of the Fish and Wildlife Service what the populations are looking like on the nesting grounds, and that's how the bag limits are set each year for people to go hunting. As I move on to the oil spill now, let me just, first, I think it's important to set the stage legally, because when a spill happens in the United States, a law kicks in called the Oil Pollution Act, and it takes over, and it is a federal-run responsibility. And under the Oil Pollution Act, the Coast Guard is responsible for all cleanup. Now, they work with the team, and there were as many as 12 agencies that sat in the command center with the Coast Guard during this spill. Fish and Wildlife Service was one, National Marine Fisheries Service, state agencies, and others sat in there to give advice to the Coast Guard on how to respond. And so the law breaks it down into three steps. The first step is emergency response. Now, that happens as long as the spill or the discharge is still occurring. This was the longest discharge in American history. Normally, it's a tanker that ruptures. It's some ship that, like the Exxon Valdez, and when it's over, then the emergency response part is over. This one lasted for almost 3 months. And so during that emergency response phase, it truly is a 100% federal command responsibility. So in the beginning, lots of organizations were thinking, well, let's send volunteers down to try and help. Ducks Unlimited, we said no. You know, we know how it works. We would only get in the way because the federal agencies and state agencies are the only ones that have the ability to go in and do something. Now, if you go in without that, let's say, for example, we had gone in and said, we're just going to go to where birds are and we're going to pick up wild birds and we're going to do things. We would have violated the Migratory Bird Treaty Act because without the consent and authority of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, you can't go in and do those things. And so we worked closely. I was on the phone with the director of the Fish and Wildlife Service and with the state directors along the Gulf Coast and simply told them, when you're ready, we'll come down. What we do is habitat. Let us know when you're ready to work on the habitat portion or anything else that we can do to help. So the first phase is emergency response. The second phase is called the natural resource damage assessment phase. And what that means is the agencies, and that again is the government responsibility, they assess what damage has occurred to the resources and start putting a dollar value on them to know how much the potential responsible party will owe in cleanup and in restoration. And that is actually a pretty long process. And so the first phase, emergency response. The second phase is a natural resource damage assessment. The third phase is, all right, we've got the money settlement. Now what's the plan to put it in place to restore habitat? Those are the three steps, and that's important to know as we move forward. This photograph really shows how horrific this explosion and spill was, and I like to begin all of the discussions of this by remembering that 11 lives were lost in this explosion. We will be talking about the natural resource impacts, but we should never forget that human life was lost in this. It was located about 50 miles southeast of the mouth of the Mississippi River, and it was in 4,950 feet of water. While the arguments are still ongoing as to the amount of discharge, we'll use these numbers as an example. The government estimate is that 60,000 barrels per day were spilled for 86 days. That equates to 4.98 million barrels of oil or 209 million gallons of oil, roughly enough to fill the Superdome one-third full. Recent NOAA and EPA reports estimate that 75% of the oil is gone, having evaporated, been consumed by bacteria, or otherwise dispersed. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. However, some subsurface oil remains. Fireballs continue to wash on the beaches, and oily sheens are still seen in some areas, so we're not out of the woods. But overall, impacts are not as severe as they could have been. One of the problems that they will have in estimating this is that natural seepage of oil in the Gulf of Mexico is an ongoing and naturally occurring event. It's going to be very hard to determine as we move forward. The further away from the spill we get, the harder it's going to be to identify which oil it is that's doing something, because thousands of barrels worth of oil every year naturally come out of the crevices and seepage of the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. And so it will become more difficult as we go forward. But one of the reasons that they think the oil has disappeared is because, unlike cold water, say, in the Gulf of Alaska, where the Exxon Valdez spill occurred, the Gulf of Mexico, because of that seepage, nature has evolved to have a niche filled by bacteria that actually feed on hydrocarbons. And so these bacteria have exploded in the Gulf of Mexico. And we're also monitoring, and government agencies are monitoring, to see possible hypoxia, because as explosions of microbial life occur, you can also have the robbing of oxygen out of the water. And so that can be a problem. But by and large, they think that the microbes have been responsible for a tremendous amount of the oil digestion, if you will, and disappearance. What were the impacts? We had about, the estimates are around 666 oil shorelines. Now, as you can see, the marsh here, that is the typical view at the extremities of the marsh right next to the Gulf. We need to keep in mind that there are 1.2 million acres of marshlands off the Louisiana coast. Historically, there was over 2 million, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. But by and large, we were fortunate when it comes to where the oil went. Most of the oil ended up that came ashore ended up on beaches. We had 666 miles, but very little of it actually went into the marsh. And what went in, this is Phragmites, or if you're from that part of the country, they call it Roseocane. And it is a salt marsh vegetative cover, and helps be the first buffer against storm surges and all other things. But it is pretty resilient, and it didn't go that far in, even though the shoreline miles were pretty deep, pretty long. We were pretty fortunate. The birds use, most of the birds use fresh and brackish marsh, and the oil didn't reach into there, so we were very fortunate. We're not out of the woods again because we're still in hurricane season. We don't know where all the oil is. It's always possible that oil could be washed up in through a storm. But we were actually pretty fortunate when it comes to what could have happened had this still occurred in hurricane season, for example. We had, through August 9th, about 5,886 birds have been recovered, of which 3,577 have been visibly oiled. Of the 5,886 recovered birds, 3,839 were dead, 1,947 were alive and brought into the rehab facilities. Only one model duck, which is surprising because model ducks are a coastal resident. They don't migrate. They're similar to a mallard, but they stay on the Gulf Coast. Only one model duck was found, and the lack of recovered ducks indicates that maybe we dodged a bullet as far as the duck population and the resident bird population there. Because when you look at these numbers and realize there are millions of birds down on the coast, obviously this is an indication of what we found. We don't know what we didn't find. And so that's the big question mark. But nonetheless, given the history of what birds are found, frankly, we were lucky if this is the extent of the damage to migratory birds. One of the things, again, that we won't know is what's going to happen and what could happen if a storm comes in. We do know that there's some oil still out there, but we just don't know where it is and how extensive it is. The one concern that we still have left from a duck standpoint, other than the storm, is scaup and redhead. Those are two species of ducks that like to get into open water and raft and feed on the fingernail clams and the microbes and the invertebrates that are out in the open water. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess, depending on if you're talking about one species or the ecosystem, unfortunately for the ecosystem, because of all the marsh that has been lost, there's a lot of open water there in Louisiana for these birds to use. And so we have still some concerns. We don't know what happened to those food populations, so we have not seen any signs that tries to figure out if they are bioaccumulating the oil, biomagnifying the oil, or the dispersants, or whether or not they were killed. And by those two first terms, I mean a filter feeder like a clam can collect the pollutants that come through it as it's feeding. And that's called bioaccumulation. It just sort of builds up. Another thing that could happen is due to the metabolism of the organism, they can biomagnify. In other words, as they are digesting, it breaks into different chemicals, and that can actually be more toxic, release more toxic chemicals. And then the third, of course, is mortality. The first, well, actually all three of those we really don't know yet. What the status of those submerged populations of invertebrates are, and we're going to have to be watching those pretty closely. We'll be also looking at that as part of that natural resource damage assessment, that phase two that we talked about. Now, Ducks Unlimited formed, I constituted a response team, 15 people of various skills from engineers to hydrologists to biologists to be prepared to go down whenever our skill set was needed, and that was to restore habitat. We also had our office in Washington, D.C. give briefings to Hill staff, and it was very well received. And we were, one of the things that I really want to point out here, Ducks Unlimited does not get involved in political frays. We focus on the habitat. We feel like that there are plenty enough entities who have the responsibility to try and determine who's at fault or not at fault. And so we did not get involved in that. We are constantly and continually focused only on the habitat. We're willing to work with anyone that will work with us to try and improve that situation. So we did not cast aspersions on BP or Deepwater Horizon or anyone else, because that's someone else's responsibility and it's not our skill set. Our skill set is trying to do something for the habitat, and so what we do is go to work with our partners. And the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation is one of our best partners. We certainly work with the National Wildlife Federation, Sierra Club, Audubon, and others. But in this case, the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, a philanthropic organization that gives out grants, gave us a grant for $3.5 million to work on the Gulf Coast habitat. And what we did was to go down and work with the local landowners. Birds are programmed to come to the Gulf Coast. They will fly down there. Their program says, I need to go from the Canadian Prairie and I need to make it to the Gulf Coast. They've been doing it for thousands of years, maybe millions, and they're going to continue to do it. What we wanted to do was to provide them an alternative. If the oil, we started this in June, by the way. You need to keep the timing in perspective. We started this work in June and July, not knowing what was going to happen. It was still spilling, not knowing what was going on. And our approach was, if the oil made it into the marsh, we wanted to provide alternative habitat that was safe for the birds when they got down there to try and keep them away from the oiled areas. Because if you provide them with good water, with good habitat, and good food in that, then hopefully we can keep them from moving too much back and forth laterally. There is no such thing as short-stopping ducks. You will hear hunters constantly complain, as I do, that all these habitat things that we're doing in Missouri or Arkansas or somewhere else along the flyway, we're short-stopping the ducks. We're keeping them from coming down, and we're hurting the hunters down somewhere. Well, let me tell you, I wish we were that good. It's far better than we are. Those birds know where they're going to go, and they're going to go there. And weather is probably the biggest driver on whether or not they move north and south. But laterally, I think if we can provide some habitat, once they get where they're going, they'll find a good safe area, and they'll feed there. So that's what we tried to do. We took the $2.5 million of that money from National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, worked with the Natural Resource Conservation Service in their WHIP and EQIP and their various programs under the Farm Bill, and we provided the 25% cost share that would have been the landowners in order to flood up habitat, farmlands, pasture lands, et cetera, to create habitat for the birds when they showed up. We knew that the first birds to arrive would be the blue-winged teal. They are the first migrants that come down. They usually arrive late August, so we started working in June and July to try and provide habitat for them. And I'll show you a little video clip with no sound. We'll do that as we're taking questions and answers of the habitat and the bird usage that we did as we finished. What we'll do now is to try and work toward the future, to build a good relationship with everyone that we can. The real issue, and this is really important to remember, our real issue is not the oil spill. The oil spill is insult to injury. The real issue is we've lost 1 million acres of Louisiana coastal marshes. That's happened through saltwater intrusion, through storms, through oil and gas canals, through development, through shipping. The Mississippi Flood Protection Project created a lot of issues. Historically, the floodplain of the Mississippi River was as much as 100 miles wide. They put the levees in and turned that nice, big, spread-out, drop soil, build marsh, and they created a fire hose. and they shoot now straight down because of the levees, the hydraulic head behind the river pushes that water to where we're losing about 18 to 19 million tons of topsoil per second as I've been standing here talking to you off the edge of the continental shelf, and that has been going on for decades. We now have a hypoxia zone off the edge of the continental shelf because of the soils coming down from the farmlands and the Dakotas on down carry fertilizer. Fertilizer creates algal blooms. Algal blooms create oxygen in the day but consume it at night, and then before long it becomes hypoxic. And so the long-term issue is how do we keep from losing a football field-sized portion of wetlands in Louisiana every 30 minutes. That's what's happening, 24 square miles per year. That's the long-term issue. That's why Ducks Unlimited has been working on the coast for 20 years and will be there until the job is done. The real issue is how do you rebuild? And we have to find a way to divert that Mississippi River water and the sediment that is used to build those marshes back over where it used to go so that we can start fighting back the issues of subsidence and seawater, sea level rise. Those are the real issues. And so now we'll switch, if you will, and while I take questions and answers, I'd like to show you a video clip. It's a silent footage so that we can talk while you're watching it. But you're looking at the habitat that we created, 70,000 acres worth of habitat for the birds on farmland, on pasture lands, and other lands that are protected behind the levees, so that we gave the birds another place to go. And as you see this usage, what you're mainly seeing in the flocks are the blue-winged teal that showed up, and you'll see some mottled dove mixed in there with them, but also you'll see egrets, herons, and other shorebirds, because as I said earlier, we're about waterfowl, not just about those birds we can hunt. We want to really have the wetlands and the beauty that comes from those wetlands as we move forward and pass those on to future generations. So with that, thank you, and I'll be glad to hear questions.